episode 15 of Comparing Apples to Oranges. I'm Mike.
And I'm Arthur David Gregg.
And we're coming at you today with a brand new episode that takes two things that don't belong in the same genre, but belong in the same category, and we're going to pit them against each other in a series of athletic and mental contests that, you know, where we look at certain criteria we've chosen ahead of time and one that we're going to come up with on the fly because we've sort of been sleeping on it.
Stated differently, we're going to take two different medias and try to run them through the same stringer. Even though they aren't usually evaluated with reference to one another, we're going to try to do it and see how they stack up.
So today, I'll tell you the two things, and Dave will tell you what the title of this episode is going to be. So we're taking Snoop Dogg's album Bush, which was produced by Pharrell, and we're going to compare it to the movie Gone Baby Gone, which was directed by Ben Affleck.
As Mike may have kind of tipped his hand here, the theme of this episode is limelight to behind the scenes. What we're kind of look at is two different media here, an album and a movie, where an individual who is normally in the limelight, you got Ben Affleck, the incomparable Daredevil, stepping behind the scenes to direct Gone Baby Gone, and you have Pharrell, noted for his Daft Punk contributions. What is it?
The movie Happy.
Miserable Me.
Happy.
He sings the song Happy. And he's also a member of NERD, which is an old hip-hop group known for such songs as Superstar and...
Something with a stripper.
Yeah, right? Lap Dance.
I had no idea he was part of NERD.
Yeah, he's the lead vocalist of NERD as well. Now, I think what we'd like to clarify, though, is neither of these are really people who were only limelight and hopped back. But it's important that both of these endeavors are after the people were in the limelight and then came back. So the idea would be, does limelight or being in the limelight affect or have an impact on how you control things from behind the scenes? So if you're an actor first, or you've had experience being an actor, can we notice that experience, the fingerprints of that experience on the way you've directed? Or if you're a vocal artist, can we notice the fingerprints of that experience on the way you produce a record? Because here, Ben Affleck was known initially for Good Will Hunting, but he kind of had a dual role in that. He was behind the scenes,
right,
and in front of the scenes.
As a writer, not, was he a director of that?
No. What okay. I just mean, though, is that
yeah.
both of these people have experience in the business before the item we're reviewing. But
yes, absolutely.
Pharrell was a producer, I think, since 1992. I mean, he's one of the counterparts of the Neptunes. And whenever I get one of those shitty five-song albums from Best Buy that have remixes, Dollars to Donuts, one of the four, is going to be a remix by the motherfucking Neptunes. So he's got some experience in there, but we want to look at that experience and see if we can see any difference in it after, you know, experience doing Happy, after his experience doing that infectious little Daft Punk song.
Yeah. Also, this is Ben Affleck's directorial debut, and it's kind of fun because he directs his brother, Casey Affleck, which is, you know, if you're going to direct somebody, you might as well be your younger kid brother that nobody likes, and then, like, make him kind of he has just a real shit job in this movie.
If you're
sad the whole time.
If you're worried as a director that you're not going to have the kind of clout you need or the authority you need, being able to call your lead actor's mom and say, "Mom,
also your mom,
he's not doing it. Tell him to do it. I'm the director, and the production company said so."
Yeah.
You know.
Also, fun fact, I found out that Pharrell was also an executive producer of a movie that... Did you see that movie Dope recently? It came out in 2015.
The one with Johnny Depp?
No, that's Blow.
Then no, I have not seen Dope.
Okay, Dope's a really good movie, and I had no idea that Pharrell co-executive produced it, which, I mean, like, that's... I think that's just money. Like, oh, so let's talk a little bit about the difference between what a music producer does and a film director does, and sort of in that conversation discuss how a producer in the music world is drastically different than a producer in the film world.
You know, when I think of producer in the film or television world, I always think of, like, a shout out or a gratuitous whatever. You know, I think you get to the fifth season of Breaking Bad and Bryan Cranston's the producer on every third episode. I'm not sure he's doing anything really all that different from the first episodes or the first seasons. You see producer tossed out kind of as an emeritus title a lot more in the, I believe there is a job of producer in the movie world, but it's kind of tossed around a lot more willy-nilly than it seems to be in the music business. There aren't seven producers on one song that I've noticed, but I've seen movies or television shows that list executive producer after executive producer after executive producer.
My take of what a producer does on... So for True Detective, both Woody... Season 1, True Detective had Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey as producers, and I think that means that they just gave money, right?
Yeah.
At some point, like a producer is somebody who helps foot the bill in some capacity, not necessarily putting in too much creative input, but the implication is, hey, I'm funding this because I like the project.
Well, and I've heard that too, that a producer's role can be limited to funding and financing and not have any kind of creative input. So it made sense here that we not compare producer to producer across the mediums, but really I think, as Mike's going to kind of develop for us here, the analog to a director of a movie is the producer of an album.
Yeah. I actually did just a teeny bit of research. I'm going to put this link on the Tumblr that I forget to update. But so the music producer is in charge of either writing the material, or if they didn't write it, in charge of organizing it, making it sound like a cohesive song. The producer calls the shots on what's played and when it's played and how it's played and the sounds that are used or the vocals that are recorded, if they're correct or not. The producer is in charge of everything. And that's a quote from a music producer. So, I mean, take it with a grain of salt. And I think what's interesting about this album, I don't know how common this is, it seems actually very uncommon, but Pharrell wrote every single song on this album. Now, he's credited with every single song. I don't know in what capacity you get a credit for writing, if like you write the beat or the words or whatever, but he's credited on every single song, and some songs have like three or four people on it too. So I don't know what that means.
You know, but I do think, I don't think it's the case that you get a writing credit just by being a producer.
Right.
I think usually that suggests him taking the laboring oar above and beyond a normal producer.
Right. And you mentioned that he had a lot of experience in this capacity before, since like 92. Granted, every time you look at Pharrell, I think he gets younger. I don't know what that is. But
he's got that Paul Rudd syndrome where he just, like if you held up a picture of Pharrell 10 years ago and
right.
today, it'd be jump all red to say which one was older.
And Ben Affleck, as a director, I mean, he picks a... I don't think he's directed anything that he wrote, because this is an adaptation from a novel. I know Batman was an adaptation of a novel. What else did he direct? Argo, that's an adaptation. Well, that happened in real life. And then The Town
mm-hmm.
was a book by Chuck Hogan. So I don't think he's super comfortable with writing his own material, but I mean, he adapts it for the screen because he's definitely changed. I never read the book for Gone Baby Gone, but I read Prince of Thieves, which is what The Town was originally called as a book, and he takes some like drastic liberties.
But he didn't direct Gone Baby Gone, did he? That was David Fincher.
You're thinking of that other movie.
I'm thinking
Gone Girl.
Gone Girl.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's rude of him to have two Gones.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, he's an actor in one, you know. You know what I mean?
I stand by it.
As actors go. Okay, so let's talk about some of our criteria that I have to bring up on my phone. One thing we're going to talk about is re-listenability and rewatchability. Which one would you rather consume as media again? So are you going to plug in that Snoop Dogg track? Are you going to like, hey, I want everybody else to hear this? Or are you going to recommend... I don't know how often you would watch Gone Baby Gone just because of the content of the film, but how would you recommend it to other people?
You know, I think what I'd say is, I think for rewatchability and re-listenability, it's inherently unfair to compare a movie to a song
okay.
or a movie to an album, because I can listen to... My favorite songs, I guarantee you, I've listened to dozens of more times
okay.
than my favorite movie.
Just
because
of length.
A movie's a commitment. You can't normally do much else during it. It requires... I can't watch a movie on the way to work.
Right.
But I have to listen to something on the way to work, and often I'll just jam favorite songs or favorite albums
right.
into that hole.
Okay. So you're saying that it's immediately has to be Snoop Dogg on that one? Or
no, I think we just have to handicap it.
Okay.
I think we have to think rewatchability compared to other movies and re-listenability compared to other albums.
Okay. And then number two, we talked about Growing Pains. Was there constraint in their ability to perform behind the scenes because they had been in the limelight initially?
You know, I think we often would think of someone doing multiple roles as being an asset, you know. A general is benefited from being a soldier and vice versa. That, like, right. If you're going to be a conductor, you should know how to play the instruments. But I think we could also see it as being to use that word again, too close to another handicap.
Right.
You know, it could be an impediment to, you know, you could be too obsessed with the acting part of it and neglect kind of the scope of the shots, or you could be too obsessed with, like, how Snoop's laying his beats, and so you neglect kind of,
like, micromanaging
the mixing. Yeah, I think
misunderstanding.
If the conductor invests himself too much into the role of the violin, he's gonna neglect the cello.
Yeah, I think that's my problem, you know, whenever I'm doing
symphonies. Neglect the fuck out of cellos.
All right, and then our third criteria we talked about
last time you said, do we even have a cello? And Bill was right over there with the cello.
Dude, Bill's kind of a jerk, so I said that to hurt his feelings. I knew he was there.
Okay, well.
All right. Well, anyway.
That wasn't clear to me.
Bill, suck it, all right? If there's anything I want anybody to take away from this, is that Bill the cellist can suck it. All right, and our third criteria, we talked about leg up or advantages or assets that the artist or performer brings to their role because they have done something in the field.
And this would be the more presumed result of someone switching roles, is that it's a benefit, that by being an actor first, your ability as a director is heightened or more sensitive as a result of your experience as an actor.
And I like to bring up that this is not the same sort of thing that made Eddie Murphy's Party All the Time such a good song, is because he was such a famous actor, you know, and it just so happened that he created, like, the best song of all time.
Well, and, you know, I'd wary our delicate listeners against the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air effect.
Where, yeah.
The songs bleed into the persona bleeds into the songs. I mean,
triple threat sort of situation.
Like, the thing is, like, I don't think you can say the Fresh Prince ever really stepped out of the limelight when he was backstage.
Right.
You know, that guy was just a one man. It's like Prince. He was just an institution. Here we're talking more about switch hitting, not being everything.
I mean, if you're starring in the movie, main character on the poster, it's your name first, even though Kevin Kline did a great job in Wild Wild West.
Will Smith didn't even have to cuss. Man, that guy was operating
He cussed,
at a different
though.
Level.
I mean, he did. He just didn't have to.
Well, like, wasn't that a thing for Will Smith for a while, where he'd wear all white and he wouldn't cuss?
Oh,
yeah, that's Eddie Griffin.
Both of those sound drastically inaccurate. But, okay, what I can say is that
I'm going to find a JPEG of at least both of them wearing all white, and
okay.
I'll send it to you.
All right. That's...
But Eddie Griffin would cuss, though.
All right. And our fourth criteria is... What's our fourth criteria?
Just fuckability.
No, gross. Oh, how about, would you rather watch or listen to another album done by this person?
Okay. Yeah, a general would you rather game.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to talk about, would you rather have X director
right.
become an actor or vice versa? I think it's going to be fun.
Okay. If you like games or pina coladas, stay tuned. All right, so let's talk about Snoop Dogg's album Bush, produced by Pharrell. It was his 13th studio album. Also, Snoop Dogg on Wikipedia is identified as an American West Coast hip-hop recording artist, which is just too many words for this guy.
He's West Coast.
Yeah, you don't need to reference that. He literally says it all the
time.
No,
you have to reference it.
All right, anyway, this came out in 2015.
You get shot if you don't reference it.
Who's going to shoot me?
The guys who shot Biggie and Pac.
All right, anyway. This came out in 2015. It featured such guest appearances as Kendrick Lamar, Stevie Wonder. How is Stevie Wonder the second person they mentioned? Gwen Stefani, T.I., and Rick Ross.
Stevie Wonder is the second person they mentioned because most people I talk to think that Limp Bizkit wrote Behind Blue Eyes and Faith.
So you're just assuming that most people that consume media are morons. Just because they are.
That's Snoop Dogg's, in the context of Snoop Dogg's album, Bush?
Yeah.
I'll say yes.
I think I'm going to put the album cover on. It's like a dog that's very blue sniffing a bunch of like topiaries. That's the cover of this album, by the way. Just
yeah.
Do people still? I mean, like, I guess when you download it,
there's a suggestion that Bush might be an entendre because a dog's sniffing it.
I thought it was reference to weed.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought because dogs always like go after your privates.
Classic. Okay, so this was produced with additional production help from by the Neptunes. Good call. The guy Chad Hugo, who's also with it. I don't know what that means.
That's Pharrell's counterpart in the Neptunes duo.
Okay. They had worked together on four such albums. Oh, what? I didn't know this. Partnership between these two artists, that's Pharrell and Snoop Dogg, has earned several singles of successes for both Snoop Dogg and Pharrell, including Drop It Like It's Hot. That's kind of fun.
Yep.
Do you know that song?
I do know that song.
Didn't know Pharrell had a hand in that. That's kind of cool.
Well, Pharrell's fingerprints are all over hip-hop music in the last decade or so. He did Like a Slave by Britney Spears. He did Hot in Her.
What?
He did Baby, I Got Your Money, wow, by Old Dirty Bastard. And then he went on to go do almost a solo production work for either Keyless or Kellis. That's probably Kellis, who does the... Baby, I got your money, don't you worry. I
said, hey, baby, I got your money. Hey. All right, and so that's what we know about the production side of Pharrell's stuff. Let's talk about the album a little bit. There are 10 tracks, which is... an unusual amount today, just because you would assume that people are just trying to lay out all their music and like get you to buy, like think it's a good idea to buy it, so they're just going to sort of knock you out with how much stuff there is.
You know, I thought that the 10 tracks was kind of low as well until you said that Pharrell had written everything,
right?
And so maybe now it's more of kind of a concept piece,
yeah.
And you know, if they're trying to impose certain parameters on it, I mean, you know, Pharrell's only going to write so much damn music for Snoop Dogg.
Yeah.
He's got a lot of other irons in the fire.
This was also the first album that Snoop Dogg put out after he had rechristened himself? He used to be Snoop Lion.
He had
was that it?
Just recently readopted the moniker Snoop Dogg.
So for a while he was doing like reggae and funk music under the name Snoop Lion, which I hadn't got to listen to. You said you listened to it.
Yeah.
What do you think?
You know, I like Snoop Dogg more. Snoop
That's
Lion. I think Snoop is at his best in the chronic 2001 era. I think the stuff he laid down under those tracks is just phenomenal.
I also liked his acting in Training Day, which he's in a wheelchair, and then Denzel Washington knocks him out of that wheelchair.
He was also some kind of marijuana dealer in some movie with Ben Stiller and... the ugly Wilson brother. Kumbo and Terry and Bosch.
Yeah. It was a remake from a 70s movie.
Yeah, Dukes of Hazzard. No.
Tango and Cash. Frankie and Gracie.
Frankie and Gracie.
All right. So anyway, what did you think about the theme of this album? What do you think the theme was?
I think it was disco funk.
This album?
This album, yeah.
Nah. This album's about smoking that weed. Did you know that?
Yeah, subject matter. I thought you were asking for an artistic theme.
Yeah, they're the same in this context.
I don't.
You don't have to stretch that hard in this one.
I have to stretch pretty
this
hard.
This is no Moving Out by Billy Joel. Can we both agree on that? This is not going to turn into a hip-hop opera.
A bottle of white.
Okay, I guess Eggs on My Face. I'm not that familiar
with
that.
That's the best Billy Joel song.
Okay. Whoa. What about River of Dreams? That's a good song.
No, it's even better than River of Dreams. Which is really just a ripoff of Paul Simon's Diamonds in the Soles of Her Shoes.
Those are really good songs I like.
Yeah, they are. But, like, there's this whole thing where, like, songwriters try to, like, harness, like, this African spiritualism and do all this, like, ha-bumba, ha-bumba. You know,
Black Snake Mambazo. What's that band?
No, not Black
Snake. Lady Snake Black Mambazo. Is that it?
I don't...
That sounded really close.
That sounds like a band I'd listen to.
No, that's...
I'm not aware of that
that's,
band.
That was Graceland with Paul Simon. That's the band he had with him.
Okay, all right. I'm down with that.
Anyway, I think I've only listened to Snoop Dogg's popular music.
Starsky and Hutch. God damn it. It was Starsky and Hutch.
I really want to like accidentally edit out the part where you're talking about that and then you just yell that part and leave that in. But God knows I'm not going to do that. Snoop Dogg talks about weed a lot and it's... He used to be, like, a pimp and a drug dealer, and now he's neither. I think he has a show with Martha Stewart, right?
You know,
is this him trying to be cool because he talks about smoking weed?
In rap success, you often see a rapper trying to flip the fact that they can no longer rap about hustling on the streets mm-hmm. to their benefit.
Right.
Like, for Eminem, it was, they say I can't rap about being broke no more. They'd say I can't rap about coke no more. Slut, you think I won't choke no whore to her vocal cords, no work in her throat no more. And for...
He's just so angry.
And Jay-Z did a lot of stuff about, you know... How he used to be on the streets and how what would or would not have sufficed. But right. now... You know,
he's a business man.
Eminem had to do kind of a switch to drugs.
Yeah.
And actually, that was a lot of D12's content was purple pills and just like kind of fucked up mescaline raps. And then Jay-Z did this whole kind of capitalism thing where he becomes a business and then he kind of laces, you know, modern capitalism with these like street elements where he's not really saying he's on the streets, but he's saying that, like, you know, he gets at businessmen like, right. you know, he would at Corner Boys. And I think Snoop is doing the same thing. Like, Snoop can't talk about, you know, being this low-end pusher. He has yeah. to, but, I mean, he has to talk about something. He's got to keep himself relevant. Yeah. And I think it makes the most sense, given his kind of Rasta leanings, that he just kind of lean into pot. I mean, every movie he's, like, done 5 minutes in and has kind of had this pot theme. And
yeah.
I imagine it gets brought up once or twice in the context of the Martha Stewart show.
Yeah, I think that's, like, the implication is that they both get baked before they bake, which is, like, I don't know. I just don't get it. It's, like, legal in California it has been for quite some time, so I think he's just, like hey, come yeah, California.
But you gotta do something, because Ja Rule got killed on that front.
That's fair.
Like, when Ja Rule, like, I remember seeing some, like, parochial school Ja Rule yeah. picture where he was wearing, like, a crushed red blazer.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, oh, this guy's fucked.
Yeah.
Like,
He had
nowhere to pivot
we're
to.
We're still talking about him. Does that count?
No?
Okay.
He's a cautionary tale.
That's fair. All right.
What's the last thing you remember Ja Rule doing?
Oh, all those memes.
Yeah.
You know what? That's DMX.
I was going to say grabbing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, but that's also DMX. That's how DMX kept himself relevant. Come on!
He did
Christmas carols.
Let's talk about Gone Baby Gone. Like, give away spoilers, or should we just talk about the premise of the film? What do you feel like?
Let's just talk about the premise. I don't want someone blasting me on Twitter with something.
So, premise of the film is Casey Affleck is a private investigator with his live-in girlfriend, Michelle Monaghan, and a little girl in South Boston.
Southie Boston.
Which is actually filmed in South Boston, which is kind of cool. And it says, most of the extras were often local passersby. Other locations used in the film were part of Massachusetts. So that's kind of cool that the Afflecks grew up there and decided to actually shoot part of the film there. So that's really cool. Premise is that a little girl goes missing. The cops are searching for her, having no luck. So they hire Casey Affleck and Michelle Monaghan to get in to the seedy underbelly of Southie culture.
I think the Guardians are rightfully concerned about kind of code of ethic in Southie Boston where no one talks to the police.
And it's also like, was there foul play? Mom's former drug addict and girl's father was like in jail or something. So they think that it's like just a domestic dispute gone wrong, but they don't know.
And they're worried the police won't give proper attention to the possible culpability of the mother, nor actually sufficiently be able to investigate since Southie Boston fucking hates cops.
Right, so that's the first, like, 8 minutes of the movie. And then it just...
Ed Harris is there. You get a brief winning smile from Morgan Freeman.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, it's a... So, as movies go, definitely not one that you...
Is that Ed Harris?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's not the chief of police, but he's, like, the local sheriff. Like, he's the... something.
Yeah.
Sheriff? I don't know. But anyway, designates itself a neo-noir mystery film, which is just really redundant. I think you could just say it's a... mystery. Neo-noir is just like a new movie that's about mysteries. But it's definitely like sort of explores the whole bad side of local town, and the whole thing with Twin Peaks took off so well. It's, you know, on the surface is one thing, but you scratch it and it's just very seedy underbelly. So the screenplay was adapted by Ben Affleck and Aaron Stockard, who it was based off a novel by the same name by Dennis Lehane. Mystic River.
And actually, fun fact, Aaron Stockard's last name shares a first name with Stockard Channing.
I don't know how fun that fact is, but it's... can't argue it, you know?
Well, it's a fact.
Yeah, that's why I'm not arguing it.
It's not an alternate fact.
All right, so anyway, this movie came out in 2007, so these aren't necessarily contemporaries of each other. Ben Affleck's first movie, then he went on to direct some more movies, star in some movies. I think this is the only movie he directed that he didn't star in. especially direct and, like, be the star in, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, Argo, he was the star in.
The Town, he's the star.
Yeah.
He was going to do Batman.
What about Phantoms? What was he in Phantoms?
I don't remember Phantoms.
Okay.
All right, so we're going to start talking about our first criteria. All right, let's talk about criteria one, realistability / rewatchability. Which of these contenders would you want to consume as a media again?
So I think, and I say let's just both kind of give a short answer where we come down, and then we can debate over it. But I think compared to other albums, Bush has less re-listenability than Gone Baby Gone has rewatchability when compared with other movies.
That makes sense to me. I think because Gone Baby Gone is not a typical movie, and because Bush is the epitome of a typical Snoop Dogg album, I would definitely prefer to rewatch or recommend another person. Both you and I watched Gone Baby Gone at least twice because we rewatched it recently.
For this.
Yeah. And
I liked it. I was surprised how much
I knew the important parts, but I forgot a lot of stuff where I'm like, no, that's pretty cool. Like,
and see, I forgot everything. I remember Morgan Freeman was in it.
Oh, really?
That was about it.
I remember specifically that. I don't think I remembered Ed Harris was in it. I actually expected Ben Affleck to pop up and was kind of surprised that he didn't.
I'd like to push back a little bit on this idea that it's a quintessential Snoop album.
Okay.
Because I think it is in its substance. But I think this is the least rap-driven Snoop Dogg album I've ever listened to.
Okay.
And that all the production kind of sweeps away the vocals. They're there, and he's singing them. He didn't write them, but Snoop Dogg participates. But here, to, you know, beat this metaphor into the ground, I kind of feel like Snoop Dogg's rapping, to the extent it's even rapping, but his vocal contributions are kind of one instrument in the symphony, whereas I think if you look at The Chronic, if you look at songs like The Next Episode, you know, Snoop Dogg's rapping sets the pace and everything else kind of gets in line behind him. Here I think it was much more collaborative and it was much less of an MC album.
Yeah, I understand that. Maybe it's not a typical Snoop Dogg album, but a typical like pop rap album. Maybe that's what I was...
Absolutely. And actually, I think it has a lot of similarities with Hot and Her and other songs where, you know, rap right now seems to be... The Vogue thing seems to be overproduction.
Right.
At least relative overproduction compared to, like, the rap of the early 90s and even the early 2000s.
Being studio used to be an insult, and now they talk about in their songs how they're, like, sitting in the studio, you know, putting in work.
Yeah, I mean, I think not only is just studio time lost its stigma, but just the process of going into the studio is so much more capable and so much more painless than it was 10 years ago in terms of re-records. There's auto-tune, there's all this stuff. And I mean, you have certain artists that pretend that certain things are above or beneath them. But
right.
At the end of the day, the process, it's like getting a root canal. Like, it used to be just the worst fucking thing to get a root canal. And now it's nothing. Now it's, you know... Do it before lunch and put my meeting back on the schedule after lunch.
Yeah, that's what my schedule looks like too.
Yeah.
So
brush your teeth.
Yeah. If we can talk about flossing for just 1 second, guys, do it.
Your teeth are the best friends you'll never talk to.
God, that's sad. That's like the saddest thing I've ever heard. Yeah. I talk to my teeth once a year.
My parents said that to me every night when I went to bed. Your teeth are the best friends you'll ever talk to.
Shh. Go to sleep. Go to sleep. All right. Catch our next podcast, which is just us whispering into the microphone for you to sleep. It is 3 hours long, comes out twice a week.
We're actually comparing teeth to hair under the common theme of things you brush.
Oh, boy. So strap in, dummies.
Strap in and strap on.
So I guess it sounds like I don't like the Snoop Dogg album, but we were just talking. There's 3 or 4 songs that I would definitely tell people to listen to, and I wanted to listen to again, but I found myself in a 10-track album wanting to skip songs.
And not even, like, the second time I was hearing
it. Yeah.
I'm like, I'd say about a minute into 7 of the songs,
right.
I would say to myself, okay, I feel like I've internalized everything this song has or will have to offer. And I just click next. But, you know, what I'll say is, I spoke in the beginning about kind of an unfairness between rewatchability and re-listenability. But I think also the modern album, it's tough for any album to be re-listenable as, like, a unit. You know, even you know, my favorite albums of all time. Like, I pick tracks out of and I plug them into mixes. Yeah. And it's very rare. It's very few and far between the albums that I'll make a note to listen to them in order as the tracks are set forth. In the Airplane Over the Sea, Nirvana, Unplugged in New York. I'm sure there's others, but it's very rare. I can count on my fingers the number of albums that I revere enough to make sure I listen to them in a certain order.
Especially track one to track whatever in order.
Yeah.
I think we're not really in the era anymore of, well, I mean, who has, you know, that amount of time? That's like sitting down watching a movie, effectively.
Like, Pink Floyd's that way. Like, yeah. Greatest hits don't make a lot of sense for Pink Floyd because money is set up by the three tracks before, right. And you can tell they want to do that. Even albums where I like all the songs, mm-hmm. like The Shins' Shoots Too Narrow, I think is one of the most consistent albums in pop. But I don't have a loyalty towards listening to those tracks in a certain order. They're all just good tracks.
Right. And then you're like, well, I'm supposed to enjoy this, so I don't really want to feel like tethered to it in this capacity.
Yeah, my ability to, you know, bow my head in servitude towards the artist's intention and listen to songs I don't like in orders I don't want, it's rarely extended.
Yes, Snoop Dogg, so get off our goddamn backs.
Yeah, fuck you, man.
All right, so what about Growing Pains? What did you see as a problem, or which album, who wins this? Is it with the fewest?
No, you win this by having the worst problem. Okay. So it's kind of tough. This is which is going to have to be taken into...
No.
For the purposes of the final calibration, this is a golf score. So we have to
mulligan.
We'll let the number crunchers back home worry about it.
They really shanked it. I know one more golf thing. I'm going to keep it in my back pocket.
Birdie.
Oh, shit. All right. It was going to be wedge. Is that a thing? A sand wedge? Oh, no, it's just a joke. Oh, man. That's kind of funny.
So I think Snoop Dogg suffered more from Pharrell's experience in front of the camera, quote unquote, behind the mic.
Yeah.
I think, you know, this album was kind of... There's a reason that in a rap or hip-hop album, the lyrics and the beat lead the effects and the production. And here I think the tail kind of wagged the dog. I don't know if it's Pharrell being used to being in front of the mic or Pharrell being used to running the show, but here, and maybe it's because he wrote the lyrics as well, but it felt like the beats were a backdrop or were at least one aspect of the production. And I think that kind of emphasis ends up not sitting well for me in a hip-hop album. And it kind of gives all of the songs a really catchy, really jazzy, really well done kind of elevator music feel. It makes all of them not really stand out. I mean, of the seven songs I didn't like, I listened to this album a month ago and this morning, and I couldn't suss them out.
Yeah, it would be interesting to hear what their plan was, because they didn't really, you know, have a press release with it. But it's sort of you're formally switching back to Snoop Dogg. Like, you're not coming up with a Puff Daddy-esque third name for your performance. It seems unusual that you would so heavily lean away from what you're known for, which is, like, strong lyrics, like, somewhat well-done beats. But, I mean, when you hear Gin and Juice, you're like, oh, I can't wait to hear, you know, the instrumentation. Or, you know, like, the original Snoop, like, Drop It Like It's Hot. Oh, no, that's a bad example.
No,
I guess.
But I think you're keying into something that's exactly right, and that this Snoop Dogg album doesn't seem to play to Snoop Dogg's strengths.
Right.
And I don't know if that's because he didn't write the lyrics, because he was just off of being Jai Rasta Man, and he was on unsure footing in terms of his lyric game,
right?
Or what? Maybe that's why Pharrell wrote everything. But it kind of has this vibe where I'm going to go ahead and hedge my bets here and say you, me, and our entire listening audience were the people that, when they were assigned to group projects, just did all the work anyway.
Well, I mean, who else is going to do the work in a group project?
And Pharrell did all the work in the group project, and here I think, as a Snoop Dogg album, it kind of suffered for it. It's a great Pharrell album, but Snoop Dogg's just one of the instruments here. So it's not...
That's a pretty intuitive way to talk about this, because if you write all the songs, do all of the music, and arrange all of it...
It's not a Pink song featuring Nate goddamn Roos.
I wonder if I walked into this one or if I knew it was going to happen.
I've been setting this up for a while now, right, over the last half hour.
That's fair. I guess...
If you don't write it, and... the person who wrote it sings it with you, then it's not your song featuring them.
So here's an interesting question for you about... So there was another podcast episode that was about collaboration albums, and I kind of wonder, like, people know who Snoop Dogg is, and in 2015, everybody knew who Pharrell was. Why didn't they just make this a collaboration album instead of a Snoop Dogg's coming back album? You know what I mean? Like, I really want to understand from the point of view of, like, hey, this is definitely a pop, hip-hop album instead of a rap album, which is what Snoop Dogg... I don't know if he was just going to go in a new direction, which, again, is, like, just choose a different name. Like, okay, so Snoop Lion and Snoop Dogg, so he'd be, like...
Snoop Lion Dogg.
That's pretty good. Now that you say it out loud, it's probably better than what I was thinking.
The Notorious Dogg Lion.
Or, like, Snoop. Snoop Boy.
Snoop Doggy Lion.
Snoop Tank.
Ooh.
Because it's like Shark Tank.
No, Snoop Fish. Snoop Cat. Oh, no, yeah. Snoop Fish. I like Snoop Fish.
Yeah. And then he could, like, because it's poppy, and then he would get into, like, the band Fish, where it's just like that, because they smoke pot.
Oh, yeah. So Snoop Fish would be jam band Snoop Dogg, and Snoop Country would be...
Snoop Horse.
Snoop Horse. I love Snoop Horse.
He's like whiskey for my men and beer for my Snoop horses.
Gin for my horse and juice for my lady.
No, what about the horse, though?
Gin for my horse, juice for my lady.
I don't know if horses should consume that much juniper juice.
I don't think they should be drinking juice.
All right. Yeah, they have really bad acid reflux as horses go.
Well, they're horizontal. All the acid spills up into them so easily.
God, that's sad. All right.
If we had to eat all food lying down, we'd have the kind of acid reflux that horses do. I know it's a tangent, but I feel passionately about this.
Yeah, that and flossing. So, okay. So I went with...
You'll never talk to your teeth.
I went with Gone Baby Gone on this one because... It just seemed like if you're going to make a movie, Ben Affleck, and you're going to use a book, which, like, that sounds like I'm criticizing directors who only use books, but Stanley Kubrick did that, and he's, you know, an insanely amazing director, and I would never criticize him for doing that because, you know, he'd come after me, you know, from the grave. But I was confused that Ben Affleck would do all this, and he's like, he sets all of it in a South Boston town, which is just his MO, is like, hey, did you know I'm from Boston? And we said yes, and he didn't look us in the eye and then just kept saying, hey, did you, like, I know about Boston, and my brother who's in this movie, we grew up in Boston, so when we're gonna, this is the movie we're gonna make. And it just seemed, just in the same way that they say an author's, all of an author's characters have the author in it in some capacity.
Nice.
You can sort of see how Ben Affleck puts himself as his brother because he's sort of the middle ground between the highfalutin Boston society and the scrubby? That's a word. Scummy?
Scummy is more accurate for South Boston.
Like the people who talk so thickly that you can't understand them in Boston sort of thing. And like the thugs. It just seemed that his brother was standing in his place.
And I think in a lot of ways... Ben Affleck was directing Gone Baby Gone from the psychiatrist's couch, and that, you know, he did this thing with Matt Damon called Good Will Hunting, and it was all about Southie Boston, and everyone kind of generally understood that, like, Ben Affleck wrote, like, 8 words, and Matt Damon wrote the entire thing. So here you have another South Boston movie, here you have another partnership between Ben Affleck and now his brother,
right.
Arguably an individual that he's going to be able to exert more influence and control over than he would have Matt Damon.
Right.
And it's the same thing, but he's occupying the role that, the creative role, that people kind of denied him in Good Will Hunting, or at least denied him recognition for.
Yeah, because he didn't want to write anything, so they're like, no, you can't direct it. He's like, but I want to.
Well, whether it's writing, directing, whatever, like, yeah. I think this was kind of his creative, see,
mm-hmm.
you know, I can do this. I don't just have to be in
Phantoms. You know how much I know about South Boston? Man, I'm going to rewatch Phantoms. I'm going to be... You know what? Guys, if we can tell you to do something, go watch Frighteners with Michael J. Fox. That's a pretty good movie.
Is it even called Phantoms?
Are you thinking of Chasing Amy?
No, I'm not thinking of Chasing Amy.
So we split on that one. All right, what about Leg Up?
You kind of agreed with me, though, once you started talking.
No, you agreed with me.
No.
Yeah. I liked that this album. I was just confused. I liked that it was poppier, because Pharrell's... Man, I've listened to that Happy song... way too much, and it's still a pretty good song. Like, I don't like it, but it's a good
remember
song.
Remember Reindeer Games?
No. Is that the one with... Is that at Christmas time?
Yeah, probably.
Okay, so we split on that criteria set. We're going to go with which one had a leg up because its creator, or the person behind the scenes, was in the field before they started this project.
Well, you know, and I kind of tip my hand to my last answer, but I'm going to say Gone Baby Gone has a leg up because Ben Affleck in front of the camera, or has primarily held himself in front of the camera. I think Ben Affleck, clearly in Good Will Hunting, clearly in the work he had done prior to this with Kevin Smith, actually, as we said, kind of Chasing Amy, Dogma.
Oh, Snoop Dogma.
Nice. Where he does hymns.
Oh, that'd be fun.
That would be fun. I think, you know, he got kind of a, if you look at the directing of, and this is where a podcast necessarily kind of suffers, because we can include music bits, but we can't include kind of visualizations. But I really liked how kind of tightly shot Gone Baby Gone was, except for the quarry scene, which was so large and so expansive that you really kind of like, it took your breath away. But I think there was a real attention to the actors and a real attention to acting that a movie like that needs to survive, where you have a mother who's kind of a piece of shit, and you have a police captain who's, you know, not as clean cut as he'd seem, and you have all these different parties that are so conflicted and occupy such conflicting and varied positions on a moral spectrum of gray. I mean, this movie needed to be kind of shot by an actor's director. And so I think Ben Affleck, being an actor up until this point, was given a leg up for this kind of source material.
Yeah, I think Pharrell knows how to make music that people like to listen to. And I think he did that with this album. However, I don't think he did Snoop Dogg any favors. I think he sort of Pillsbury Doughboyed him. He softened him up. All of his songs are about how he's rich, but we know that he's been rich for a really long time. And like, there's a line where he says, "She's DTF."
DTF, cause she's down to feel that aromatic mind and liking, baby, this is for real. Are you a freak? Or what? I'm just a squirrel.
It's about, the song's about, like, freaks, and he's like, hey, she's DTF, and then he says that she's down to feel, and it's just dumb. Like, it was dumb. It's catchy as hell.
Well, it's in my head. And the thing is, Snoop Dogg isn't this, like, nerdcore Childish Gambino hip hop.
He doesn't know what to do with instruments.
He doesn't know what to, I mean, down to feel. He's like, man, the fuck?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, he probably like had to really swallow like a lot of the N-words.
He loves saying that.
But I mean, I think that gets back to kind of a really compelling question, Mike, you asked in the context of the last category, is why market this way?
Yeah.
Why have this be, whatever the reason was, suffice it to say that it feels more about marketing and less about an organic description of the product.
Right.
That this is a Snoop Dogg album produced by Pharrell. Yep. Really, it should be more like a Pharrell album featuring Snoop Dogg quite a damn lot. Or at least kind of one of those Jay-Z, Kanye, Watch the Throne collaborations.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of those, it also seems like the point that it's happening, like Pharrell being the producer, is the get. It's like when the movie Hero came out, that was by the director of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and they said Quentin Tarantino presents Hero, and you're like, he didn't do anything except like quote unquote bring it over to America, and everybody's like, oh, I'll go see it, because like Kill Bill was, you know, 2 years old or whatever.
Or let's reference one of my long-standing gripes. When you look at the previews for Pan's Labyrinth, the trailers for Pan's Labyrinth contain about 73% magical, surreal imagery.
Pan's Labyrinth.
The movie itself contains about 5% magical surrealism, and the other 95% is some Chilean officer holding a fucking 1993 pistol to some asshole's head,
for
and
most
everyone's
of the
crying
movie.
And screaming. Like,
I liked it though.
It was a really good movie, but it was a bait and switch in terms of how they sold it.
So hard.
It's almost like they didn't trust an album by Pharrell and Snoop to do well, or an album by Pharrell featuring Snoop to do well, so they had to dress this up in the clothing of Snoop Dogg's comeback.
It's also like,
because they didn't trust the source material. And whenever the marketing team doesn't trust the source material, I'm going to be apprehensive walking into it. And I think once I got two songs deep, I probably got apprehensive for the remaining eight songs because I was like, why is this being presented to me this way?
And I think the reason we brought up those two instances are because those are sort of the exceptions that prove the rule. Like, you can come up with those examples quickly because those stuck out as like, oh yeah, this was supposed to be something else, but I still liked it. Where whenever you see a movie and all the or comedy and all the funny parts are in the trailer, like, I can't name one of those because that's most of them.
Well, that's just it. I mean, these are examples because the fuck up was noticeable but didn't damn the enterprise. But most of the times, the fuck up just is endemic of this whole thing is flawed and goofy and stupid. And, you know, it's like when they have those lists of, like, the worst band of 2009. Right. Like, the worst band is some, like, four kids in the garage and they don't have any instruments and they just scream. It's not Creed, okay? Creed's better than the worst band ever. It's just the worst, most popular band.
Yeah, I remember having this conversation when I was, like, young and dumb 3-4 years ago with my dad about... This morning. I'm like, Dad, they just said Obla Di Obla Di by the Beatles was the worst song of all time. And he said, well, that doesn't... I mean, it's the Beatles. It's not...
Yeah.
All their bad stuff's way better than a lot of other people's good stuff.
Every time I've heard a list of worst songs, the music was all performed well.
Yeah. You know, it was an album.
There was instrumentation. Chords were played correctly.
Yeah. Even, like, Rebecca Black's Friday is, like, better than a lot of people's music.
It's cohesive. She paid good money for that.
Yeah, well, her parents did, I don't think. So I also went with Gone Baby Gone for a leg up. Here's why I thought a good neo-noir movie should do. It's primarily actor-driven. Like, the plot is there, but the plot takes 3 seconds to explain and could potentially take, you know, 3 seconds to solve. But the whole idea is that you're going to watch these people interact and you're going to get on one person's side and then something's going to come out and it's going to, you know, shake your foundations and you have to re-examine who is what, who is who, what, you know, people's intentions, all that stuff. And I think that Ben Affleck's been in enough movies with enough people where he knows what a good, you know, conversation, a good set of dialogue, what you should focus on, all that sort of stuff. I thought the way the people interacted, definitely, because it was so well done, I think it pays tribute to that he was an actor before.
Well, and you know, I think, and I didn't know this going into this podcast, but it makes a lot of sense that Ben Affleck chose a screenplay that was adapted by the same person who adapted Mystic River. Because Mystic River, also a relatively simple story that's made good by a lot of very strong performances.
Also, premise is a mystery, but then, you know, dark shit goes down.
Also directed by a notorious actor turned director,
right,
Clint Eastwood. You know, maybe that's just the kind of movies that actors know to get their feet wet with in the realm of directing. It's not special effects, it's not elaborate cutscenes. It's these close shot, relatively... The plot of Gone Baby Gone isn't simple, but it could be done in half an hour. But what's good about it is all the painstaking anguish of these characters fighting through this kind of apathetic minutia and, like, just despair over the death of this little girl.
Yeah, no, I agree. So, what about our last one? Would you listen to another album if it was produced by Pharrell? Would you watch another movie if it's directed by Ben Affleck?
I guarantee you I've already done both those things without even knowing it. I mean, Pharrell, I was stunned when I went through the list of things Pharrell did. Hot in Her, yeah. I'm a Slave for You, The Gift and the Curse for Jay-Z, and The Blueprint 2, just the entire album. That guy is everywhere.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the real reason that you put stuff out under Snoop's name is because it's not a big deal when Pharrell does something anymore, because he just seems like the busiest man in hip-hop.
I was originally, like, super behind Ben Affleck being, you know, writer, director, star. Or not writer. Yeah. Co-writer, you know, screenplay, whatever. And then I, like, sort of re-examined the movies, and this is the only movie where the main character is an ambivalent hero, not necessarily, like, an anti-hero, because God knows I don't think he would have the guts to do that. All of the other movies where he is in the movie, he is, like, very drastically the center of attention. Like, in Argo, at some point, he's just shirtless in a room by himself. There's no reason for it. And he's the director. He said, you know what? Let's do a 3-minute shirtless scene. And his editor's like, we got to cut it down from the 2 hours that you filmed. And he's like,
anything but that scene.
He's like, okay, let's just get rid of this.
It's so funny to imagine that scene in Argo, because he would have to yell action and cut.
Right.
And like, he's just standing there shirtless. Action!
Right.
And then just flexes.
Yeah.
And then he yells, cut!
And it's not a necessary part of the movie. Like, I'm sure there's a part in the movie where, like, this person needs to not be wearing a shirt, but this is just him alone in a hotel room, and you're like, there's no dialogue, he's not on the phone, he's not doing anything, it's just him sitting back from a chair and not wearing a shirt, and I'm like, yeah.
Well, and I think that's the real risk of it. It's kind of beyond what we're talking about here, but that's the real risk of an actor's director, who was an actor, directing himself,
right,
is that the movie becomes him just holding up a mirror to himself for 2 hours.
And not in the way that, like, holding up a mirror to society, it's like, no, he's like, no, it sounds like I'm body shaming him. He looked great, like, you know.
No, but it's a vanity piece.
Yeah, def. Oh, def. But I'm going with Pharrell then.
I actually had a different idea for this category in Would You Rather. And I think what we should do is actually just pose to each other Would You Rather questions about people switching sides.
Okay. So I'm going to take just a 30-second break to tell you that we decided Gone Baby Gone is the better piece of media because Ben Affleck, as a director, former actor, outperformed Pharrell on Snoop Dogg's album Bush as a artist turned producer in our little contest. So now that we got all that baloney out of the way, let's get into some silly stuff. It's time for us to give you recommendations, artists stepping out of the limelight to move behind the scenes. So, I have a actor turned director that still acts in his movie he directs. We talked about Mystic River and Clint Eastwood. I picked Unforgiven, which this exquisite, super long cowboy movie that sort of takes a realistic and harsh view of all of the cowboy movies that Clint Eastwood did when he was young with Sergio Leone and like the whole spaghetti western sort of thing, where it de-glamorizes everything and it's super harsh and the main character is just this terrible person, and the film just moves along at an incredible pace even though it's, you know, 2.5 hours long, and it's brutal and it's great to watch. Not one of the ones where you're just like, you know what, I think I'm just going to pop this in and chill out. But it's definitely a movie that I think everybody should see.
I'd second that recommendation of Unforgiven. I think it's the one of the best westerns, second only to
that,
The Wild Bunch.
Yeah.
I mean, it's in a top five for sure.
Especially because I love The Good, Bad, and the Ugly. But, I mean, he literally, they shoot off so many hats in that goddamn movie. Like, every 30 seconds, they're shooting a hat off of someone.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, shooting hats is funny, don't get me wrong, but as westerns go, I prefer the actual view of the West, where it's like, nope, these guys were just murderers, everybody was a criminal out there, that's why they called it the Wild West, is because everybody was a bad person.
You know, actually, I'd probably pick, I've actually selected Clint Eastwood for a very similar reason. The first kind of spaghetti western Clint Eastwood did after the Sergio Leone series was High Plains Drifter, and whereas Unforgiven was kind of a more gritty, more modern humanistic portrayal of like the kinds of stories set forth in those spaghetti western movies, High Plains Drifter is really just a love letter to Sergio Leone. It's just his version and his interpretation of what made those movies great and perfect, and I think he was really benefited from being an actor directed by Sergio Leone. I mean, here it's not really as artistic of his endeavor as you might think, where an actor, you know, learns about being a director from a director and then jumps in. Here, he was mimicking the director he had been directed by for numerous films prior, and High Plains Drifter, I just think, is one of the more... It's my favorite of the spaghetti westerns, even though it's not done by Sergio Leone himself, and I think it's just a phenomenal flick.
Here's the thing. You could just keep going on about Clint Eastwood, because he's in just so many movies. And we're not talking about any Which Way But Loose or Space Cowboys. But, I mean, any of the, you know...
Love of the Game.
I didn't see that. Any of the Dirty Harry movies... Some
pitching movie where he's a baseball scout.
Oh, you're thinking of Moneyball.
No, I'm not. I like Moneyball.
Yeah, because Clint Eastwood's in it. He's great.
Jonah Hill and Moneyball is my spirit animal.
I'm not going to take that. I don't know. Don't make that noise. Anyway, But I mean, just Gran Torino is just such a good movie. Even Million Dollar Baby, which is like he's just directing himself being someone who shouts at like this young woman who's trying to make more of her life. Like, that's a great movie. Yeah. It's hard for me to find a movie.
Changeling's bullshit, though.
He directed that?
Yeah.
Oh, that's too bad.
Changeling is bullshit. I thought Changeling was fucking stupid.
I wonder if he got to the point where he was like Stephen King in it for a while, where people are just like, we don't need to edit him. Everything he does is good.
Yeah.
Because the morons like me who just said that sentence. Damn. So those are our recommendations. Now on to our little game we came up with, Would You Rather. So, Dave, I'm going to give you the challenge of the Kevins. Would you rather see a movie directed by Kevin Spacey or Kevin Bacon?
Ooh. I'd say Kevin Spacey. He does all that Inside the Actor shit. He seems to be an actor's actor. I trust him to have worked with
It's a comedy.
A broader swath. It's a comedy?
And it's not animated, but there is a dolphin. It's not a talking dolphin.
I was assuming not animated.
Why?
Because that'd be such a game changer. I don't even know what a director does for an animated movie. He just draws it? I don't know.
No,
Isn't the
oh shit? I have no idea. Yeah,
draw it different. I don't know. I don't know what a director does.
Make his eyebrows.
Storyboards.
Bushier.
Yeah. Okay. Push up those eyebrows.
So a comedy directed by Kevin Spacey about a dolphin. Yeah, Did you see that?
Yeah. He was in K-Pax. That was humorous.
But Kevin Bacon's movie is a teen coming of age story about a kid with polio in 1940.
I've already seen that Simon Birchhassel thing. I don't have any interest in any movies about kids with diseases.
Take that, Jack.
I watched
the movie Jack.
I didn't know what you meant, Jack. Take that, Curious Case of Benji.
Benjamin Burton.
Benji.
Benjamin Boots. All right, your turn.
All right, would you rather see a movie starring Ron Howard or John Landis, the director of Blues Brothers?
So, that's a terrible question for a lot of reasons. One, what's the movie? Like, is it a biopic? Because I've watched the hell out of a biopic.
Ron Howard. It's a remake of Taxi Driver.
Ooh.
With him playing Jodie Foster.
the barely adolescent prostitute?
The sassy 12-year-old trick.
Wait, who is it? Like, is it still the same? Is Robert De Niro, like, current Robert De Niro still have a mohawk?
No. Now it's played by Ryan Gosling.
Does Ryan Gosling have a mohawk?
Yeah.
Can I just watch that part?
Yeah, but you have to go see it.
Hmm. Okay, so I was...
hold on. To be fair. And then John Landis is doing a remake of A Streetcar Named Desire.
Oh, God.
Where
he's the streetcar.
He plays...
Blanche?
Marlon Brando's character.
Oh.
And
could have been a contender.
Blanche DuVois. No, it's on the waterfront.
Shit.
And Blanche DuVois is played by Gwyneth Paltrow.
All right, so you're clearly playing it up. No, I know who it is.
Stella.
I'm definitely going to go with Ron Howard because of Happy Days. Like, he has the chops. And
he has perfect cadence.
Here's
the
thing is, like, when I saw him as a non-Opie, I was floored at how old he got in such a little amount of time.
Well, you know, that squirrely-looking fucker that's in Apollo 13 and all that stuff, that's like...
Gary Sinise?
That's Mo Howard. That's like his brother.
No, I know who we're talking about.
Yeah.
Ron Howard looks like he's a skeleton.
No, but I'm saying, like, brother's even worse. The brother looks like Ron Howard from Deliverance.
All right. Okay, here's mine. Would you rather listen to an album directed or produced by Lady Gaga or Lady Antebellum?
Lady Gaga.
Okay. Lady Gaga. I just did a double lady. Sorry. Yeah.
You're gonna direct me towards the answer doing double lady.
Okay, but...
Or Lady and the Tramp.
You're like two dogs doing music. I've heard that before.
Spaghetti.
But Lady Gaga does an all blues album performed by white people. It's a cult.
British Invasion blues?
Yeah.
Like Clapton?
Well, I mean, she's not going to get Clapton. That'd be outrageous. No, she doesn't have that.
She got Tony Bennett.
She did that once.
Twice now.
Damn, that's a lot.
That's like 40 songs.
All right, now your turn.
The Lady is a Tramp. All right, would you rather listen to an album produced by, what's that guy's name? Flavor Flav.
Okay.
But current Flavor Flav, where he's all fucked up and he can't talk right.
Yeah. Well, he couldn't talk right before, but...
Yeah, but...
Now he's brainwashed.
But 911 is a... That's a... one of the best rap songs I've ever heard in my entire life. Yeah.
911's a joke.
911's a joke.
That's a good
one. So, current Flavor Flav producing a new single by Jewel.
All right.
Or... or the Asian upright bass player from the Avett Brothers.
Okay. I know him.
Yeah. Producing a new Daft Punk single about orgasming in space.
Do I know it's about orgasming in space? Like, is it self-evident in the lyrics? Because I didn't know their one album was about space robots.
It comes out in the lyrics.
Ah, shit. I walked into that one. Literally, guys. Gross.
We literally walked into the cum.
All right.
We're having a lot of fun.
Probably the cellist.
He's a cellist?
No. There is a cellist.
Is the Asian guy the cellist?
Yeah, the Asian guy's the cellist. The, like, doofy guy's the bass player. But, I mean, I know who you're talking about. Okay, I've got an actual good one now. Okay. Tracy Chapman directing an AC/DC cover band, or Macy Gray directing Nas reboot album.
So I do Macy Gray doing a Nas reboot album because Macy Gray did a collaboration with Fatboy Slim called Demons, which is really good.
But not collaboration. Oh,
yeah,
I mean, she can work in that realm.
I
totally understand.
All right, okay. So then I'll do for my final one, and I'll just kind of do a cool little blur it all together one.
Oh, fun!
Lady and the Tramp. Yeah, that Lady and the Tramp one. Would you rather see Sleepless in Seattle starring Kanye West as Billy Crystal?
Oh. I thought he was going to be Billy Crystal's kid in the movie.
No, it's Billy Crystal. And Justin Bieber in a wig as Meg Ryan. Or a remake of Apocalypse Now with Martin Sheen's character being played by, I was going to say Selma Hayek, but probably a music person. Martin Sheen's character played by Mike Shinoda of Linkin Park.
That's a deep cut, bro. That's a deep cut. Yeah. Shit.
And Marlon Brando being played by John Popper from Blues Traveler.
Here's the thing.
No.
Who gets
no
to
qualification?
No, I have a question. I have a question. Who gets to say that I love the smell of napalm in the morning? Which character says that?
John Popper.
Does he say it with a harmonica in his mouth?
I love the smell of napalm in the morning. He says it like... Yeah, he's got the harmonica robot in his neck, too.
You know what? I don't think... I go with Sleepless in Seattle
just
every time.
Just imagine Kanye West saying, I'll have what she's having.
Well, no. Justin Bieber says that.
I don't know. I've never seen it.
Really? It's a pretty good movie.
No, I've seen it. It's good.
All right. I also always confuse Sleepless in Seattle with When Harry Met Sally.
They're based off the same. You've got Mail, Sleepless in Seattle, and When Harry Met Sally. Like,
one has Tom Hanks. I think.
Yeah.
I think Tom Hanks.
Oh,
is
yeah. So When Harry Met Sally is Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan.
Yeah.
And then Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks is You've Got Mail and Sleepless in Seattle and
Joe
City
of
Angels is Nicolas Cage and Meg Ryan.
Yeah. Would you rather watch a movie that has Christopher Nolan as the lead role in the Goonies?
Yeah.
Or watch a movie directed by Christopher Walken that tells the story about how pancake artists got their job.
Pancake artists. Easy.
Damn it.
Would you rather watch Lee Daniels, The Butler, starring Quentin Tarantino as The Butler? Or would you rather watch Mystic River, but every character is played by Jamie Kennedy?
Oh, man, he's going to get so X'd.
He's going to get so X'd.
Here's the thing. I'm pretty sure that's, like, Quentin Tarantino has that film already, and it's being shot at some art
house. He doesn't shy away from the N-word.
Yeah.
He doesn't shy away from that N-word.
Despite, like, Samuel L. Jackson keep telling, he's like, no, man, like, you probably shouldn't.
Yeah.
He's does like,
it,
yeah, but probably.
Does it say dead storage on my house? Samuel Jackson.
Yeah.
He can't be a dick
because
he needs some storage.
I don't know. I guess, can I watch them both at the same time?
No. Screaming on the screen?
All right, definitely not the butler.
Yeah, no, that's really problematic. I have no intention to be that butler.
All right. What about Dwayne The Rock Johnson directing Les Mis, or Hugh Jackman directing Leonardo DiCaprio's Romeo plus Juliet.
I think Hugh Jackman doing Romeo plus Juliet, actually. He's got an artistic sense, and I think he'd do well with that movie.
But I mean, like, it was already a movie that was based on a play that they just, like, literally read the lines from Shakespeare. So what's he going to do?
I think he'd do more with it.
No.
Change up the pacing.
No. The answer was The Rock.
The pauses. I like The Rock.
But. It's like everybody's miserable because they're not, like, working out, and then they just work out, and then it's like, I guess we're...
And he just wins for, the, like, the Rebels real quick.
He just throws the people's elbow and crushes the
He just people's
French
elbows
aristocracy.
The fuck out of Jean Valjean. End of movie.
Somebody had to.
It doesn't even go to the second part.
Walking Tall.
Great movie.
That's all right.
The Rundown's better.
Way better.
Yeah.
I
was thinking of The Rundown when I said, well, great movie for Walking
Thank
Tall.
God.
All right.
Okay.
Signing off.
This is Mike.
And Dave Gregg.
This has been Comparing Apples to Oranges, where we compared Snoop Dogg's album Bush, that was produced by Pharrell, and the movie Gone Baby Gone, that was directed by Ben Affleck. And
reviewing it for comparisons between different pieces of media where players normally in the limelight treat to behind the scenes and how that affects their work.
Do you have anything that you want to plug? I don't know how that works. I don't have any. This is the only thing I plug.
Yeah, no, I'm
self-redundant.
I'm just going to plug the next time I do this.
Or the last time you did it, so.
Yeah, episode 7?
Yeah.
Yeah.
With Pink. We'll catch you guys then.
Yeah, doing the Pink.
Oh, no. All right, bye.
Baby, you can be a movie star.
Thanks for listening. This has been episode 15 of the podcast, and I hope you liked this one. Look us up on Tumblr. We are comparing apples to oranges. That's all one word, .tumblr.com. That's where all the links for my co-hosts and info about upcoming and past episodes will be. Any comments or ideas for future episodes of the podcast, please send it to. On Twitter, it's @thecatopodcast. That's all one word. Or email us at catopodcast@gmail.com. Our intro, outro, and music bed music was Thumbs Up by a great artist named Leisure B. If you liked it and want to check out more of that artist's stuff, go to humanworkshop.com. All right, hope you're enjoying summer. Bye.